Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's February 11th. Currently, we've got 13 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly cloudy skies. Heber City reporting 17 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, we've got some interesting weather heading our way, Liz. Let's just call it that here as we go into the next couple of days here. So even starting with today. So we've got those clouds out there. You probably noticed those with those cold temperatures. It's not going to warm up much today as we get into the mid-20s for highs in Park City. We're talking highs only around 30 degrees for the Heber Valley. And out of those clouds, we've got another cold front that's moving through. And so anytime, I would say, from lunchtime and into the afternoon hours, we'll likely see areas of snow flurries and snow showers developing as we go into the afternoon hours as those winds pick up out of the north and west and that colder air begins to pour in. So don't be surprised to see some snowflakes flying around as we go into the afternoon and early evening hours. Along with that, as you get up towards Park City and some of the higher elevations, it would not be impossible to pick up an inch or two of snow from this event as it moves through. But it's a fairly minor event, and the chances are not that high to see that, but could see up to an inch or two. Now, in the Heber Valley, could pick up a dusting, maybe a covering if you get a good burst of snow for a brief period of time. But again, this is not going to be shut down the roadways type of snow, but just something of a novelty. What it really spells, though, is the very cold air that's going to be pouring in behind this front. And by the time you wake up, as you get into your early Wednesday morning, it is going to be very cold out there. Probably one of the coldest mornings we've seen so far this winter season. In fact, in Park City, we're expecting low temperatures right around 0 degrees. So we're not talking about temperatures. It could be one below or one above, but right around zero is fairly likely across the area. And in the Heber Valley, you're not going to be much warmer. We're talking about temperatures only dropping down to around 2 degrees or so. So, yeah, give or take a degree or two, you can see you're not too far away from zero as well. So it's going to be pretty cold, and there will be a little wind, so especially for tonight. So expect some wind chills to be pretty dangerous below zero as we go throughout the overnight hours. Now, as we go throughout the day on Wednesday, we'll be cold, but at least we'll start to see some sunshine. At least peeking through, we'll call it partly cloudy skies. But again, very cold during the afternoon with high temperatures not getting out of the teens, probably somewhere around 17, 18 in Park City and highs only in the 20s, mid-20s, about 25 or so in the Heber Valley. And then as we get into your Thursday, that's when the atmospheric river arrives. We're talking about snow moving in, starting probably Thursday afternoon and continuing off and on Thursday night through Friday, Friday night right on into Saturday. It could mix with a little rain in the Heber Valley briefly as we go throughout the afternoon hours on Friday, but for the most part, we're looking at mainly snow coming in, and it could pile up, especially places like Park City, where we could see, we won't put numbers on it just yet, but we'll just say definitely some double-digit snowfall totals possible, and then in the Heber Valley, we could see a significant snow event as well. So, Leslie, it might be quiet to start this morning, but we've got a lot of active weather moving our way this week.
Okay, Cedric, thanks. And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Morning, Leslie. We have the full accident report published for the Monte Cristo fatality. That's up just east of Huntsville in the Ogden Area Mountains. So that's published online. We've also published the accident report for the full burial and partial burial. These were both live recoveries in Dutch Draw. That was also on Saturday. This is along the Park City Ridgeline. I should note that both of these incidents, the full burial and the partial burial, were skiers ducking the rope at the 9990 Canyons Park City ski area. But very glad there was no worse outcome with that. Still working on the report from the fatality in East Bowl Silver Fork. I've written a little bit about that on the morning's forecast. And I should also mention that Craig Gordon will be at the Ecker Hill Middle School tonight at 6:30 to 8 for a State of the Snowpack presentation hosted by the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association. You can reserve a spot online, and I'm sure he'll have all your answers for all the questions about not just the snowpack, but all the accidents of late. There are two very large, two more very large accidents, Leslie, two very large avalanches triggered yesterday in the backcountry, one along the Cardiac Ridge. This was probably 2 to 3 feet deep, couple hundred feet wide. I happened to be in town at the hospital interviewing the survivor of Saturday's fatal avalanche when my phone was blowing up about this large avalanche on the Cardiac Ridge with initial reports of maybe multiple people caught in the debris. Fortunately, that did not bear out and nobody was caught at all. But it's just something to see when you're interviewing another accident, another person from another accident. There's another close call just across the street yesterday in the White Pine Range, Alola Cottonwood Canyon. Leslie, this was 2 to 3 feet deep, 300 feet wide, a solo skier on the uptrack. It broke out 300 feet above him, and he was caught carried for 500 feet. Fortunately, he was able to just stand up and dust himself off and ski away. I don't know what else needs to be said, really. It's dangerous in the backcountry. You know, areas of considerable danger exist and will continue to exist on mid and upper elevation, northwest, east-facing terrain. We have a very complex, complicated, and tricky snowpack. Again, I may have said this yesterday, but when things get complex, tricky, dangerous, the solution's easy. Just choose your terrain wisely and that slope angle, just beyond 30 degrees or less. Choose low angle terrain and still excellent skiing and riding. But again, the big picture is coming home to your family at the end of the day. So as always, folks, get more information, see more pictures, information online at Utah Avalanche Center.
.org. And the skier that had that break above him there in the North Bowl of Lake Peak, did he have any kind of flotation device on? I mean, to just get up and ski away?
If not but for the hand of God, no airbag, no flotation.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. And then the one again that you show of Cardiac Ridge, that is one steep ski line there. Yikes.
It's really the lion's den. I mean, it's right there at the, I mean, it's sort of the central avalanche location in the Wasatch, I would say, just off the backside of Superior in the upper Cardiac Bowl, Cardiac Ridge there. It's certainly the lion's den in there.
Okay. Hey, Drew, thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
The Summit County Council meets tomorrow, starting in work session at 4:10 in the studio with a preview. I have County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning. Ooh, let's get you turned on here. There you right, microphone. Yeah. Okay, Council will start with a legislative update. What's the latest with the no ban on hunting bill? That's House Bill 309.
Well, we've interacted with the bill sponsor a fair amount. Maybe for the listeners, there is some concern about that. We have prohibited hunting on the 910 as we work to acquire that. And this bill, I think, would fly in the face of that. It would prohibit us from prohibiting hunting. So we're working with the bill sponsor. We feel like there's been some concessions made on his part to not run that bill, to either pull that bill or to remove that provision that would limit our ability to limit hunting.
Okay, and is he coming back with something else, or is it just that this is large enough property? I mean, is he defining perhaps acreage, or?
My understanding was he was going to remove that part of the bill that would prohibit a county or another landowner organization from prohibiting hunting on their land. I believe he was going to remove that. That was his intention. Talks were very productive, but that's something we're watching every day. That bill still is an open bill, and so we're still monitoring that every day. I texted about it this morning.
Yeah, so where did that come from? Are there some other locations where, you know, they want to see hunting and there's...
I'm just speculating, so I really have no inside information. I have heard that as the elk have moved down Parley's Canyon onto that golf course, those folks, that golf course, individuals that care about wildlife, were concerned that the prohibiting of hunting on the 910 has somehow caused that, or that was an effect there. Now, the owner has never had hunting on his property in the 30-something years he's owned it, so I don't find that to be a credible cause, but I've heard that those elk being down there the last couple of years has made this top of mind to some legislators.
Yeah, and did you reach out to the owner of the 910, David Bonolfo, and ask for his reaction?
No, but I myself have not, but he has interacted with the county and especially the legal team. They've gone back and forth about what we are doing and what we're trying to do. And of course, I think he's making an effort to also interact with the legislature as well. So I think we're on the same page with we want to be able to prohibit hunting on that property.
Okay. Let's see. We're hearing about a new bill. It's not numbered. It appears the legislature will attempt here to take over local control through what is known as land use implications in exchange for funding through, let's call it the Mightaway, tax increment financing for Olympic facilities. So I guess my first question is that I thought we had all of the facilities we needed, and that's why our 2034 bid was such a great bid, because we were recycling all of our facilities from the 2002 Winter Games.
Well, I think we're as prepared as an Olympic venue can be. There are obviously still infrastructure needs, transportation needs, transit needs. So depending on what exactly that would fund, you may be familiar with speaking with Colin Hilton about the UOP and their ongoing efforts to sustain themselves financially as well. So this might be able to assist in that endeavor. But exactly what this is actually can be used to pay for, I'm not sure yet.
You mentioned transit and transportation. I mean, what needs are those? Because the way we did it is that we used the Dakota Pacific property and just, you know, nobody came into town. They parked right there, and we had buses.
Well, I think we need to do similar things. Some of those places where we used to park folks in 2001 are probably now buildings and other infrastructure, so we're going to need to work around that. But, you know, 224, 248, those are both pinch points that we need to alleviate traffic coming into town. But exactly what we're trying to do, BRT is something we've been talking about, and it has been probably not fully funded, but we've got a sizable amount of grants, both state and federal, to work towards that. And then a lot of what we've talked about is timing. If this is, for example, the 224 Fink-Kimball Junction interchange, if that's on the STIP for, 2035, that's not going to work for us. So hopefully the Olympics will be able to move some things up and then also provide some funding to pay for these things.
And again, when we start talking about, we're going to have to make concessions and land use implications, is it worth it? I mean, are we making a deal with the devil here?
Right. You ask a different person, you'll get a different answer. I'm someone who is concerned about our housing situation, not only for our community, but for the employees that work for Summit County. We are more and more importing our workforce. And what terrifies me, Leslie, is Maida and Mayflower, the 2,000 employees that are going to be necessary for that operation when it's up and running, and where do they come from, and how does that affect Summit County and the folks that work here. So the deal with the devil, I guess, is in housing, and as we bring people, we also, I think Councilmember Armstrong makes this point a lot, is that for every person that lives here, we need to provide services for that person. So it's kind of perpetual in how we grow. So that's also a concern that we have, and striking that right balance is really challenging. One way we really differ from, I think, the Wasatch Front is, I think there's a mentality at the legislature, build, baby, build. The more that you build, more housing you build, the more affordable it'll be. And that may be the case in rural Utah. If you put 1,000 units in Delta, that probably might affect your affordability, but that's not going to work for us up here. So we need to do things differently. What we do in housing, if we do housing that's affordable, we need to restrict it on deeds, and maybe we need to look for other options as well.
House Bill 55, this apparently would allow county buildings to be built outside the place of business. And I guess I, when this was brought to my attention by Connor, I mean, is Summit County breaking the law since we already have the Justice Center, the jail, and other facilities outside of Colville?
We've wondered that as well, if this would have an effect on us. We don't want to get in the habit of having major operations outside of Colville, where our most of our elected serve as their office. You're right, we have the sheriff and county attorney. They both have a presence in Colville as well. They're there a regular amount. So I think there's that tie-in still. But if you looked at the operations of the sheriff's office and the county attorney in the justice court, it's so big, it was just made sense to be where it was from a logistics standpoint. So I don't know what this would do for us. We'll always have a presence in the courthouse, and I don't think we change anything from, for example, the treasurer, the auditor, the assessor's office. We'd still work out of those offices there in Colville.
All right. I guess so. Just the fact that they're built, were sort of grandfathered into this then?
Yes. And I mean, if I think about other parts of Utah, I know that there have been fights when there is a small community next to a big community, and that big community is not the county seat. There have been these arguments not only about changing the county seat, but just where you can have your offices. And so maybe this is facilitating that. But as we looked at the bill, we didn't think it would affect us in any way.
All right. Also another one, House Bill 456. This is the transient room tax bill. Don't know a lot about this. What do you know?
So one thing I can tell you to lead off is it was much worse a couple of weeks ago than it is today. So as we've interacted with the chamber, we feel like where this landed was in a really, really good place. This would increase the state portion of TRT 1% from 0.32 to 1.32. That additional 1% would be 0.5% would go to the state, 0.25% would go to a grants process available to 4 through 6 counties, and 0.25% would be point of sale, so we would see some additional revenue there. So. The key to this bill for us is the increased flexibility in what we can spend TRT on. So we've been looking for that third class county to be added to those counties that can mitigate the impacts of tourism with their TRT. And we believe not only can third class counties, but all counties are able to do that with this bill if it passes how it is today. So we were afraid of TRT being used to be more distributed throughout the state, and that would hurt us as a big producer of TRT. But that's not what this is doing. There is that grant portion, but that's only an additional 0.25% of revenue. So we're pretty happy with where this is today.
All right, and any idea what that might raise, a quarter percent coming into the county?
I should have had that prepared, and I could probably do the math, but you'd have to give me maybe a minute or two. So
that's okay.
Yeah.
And then the grant portion of it, is that something that the county, or any county could apply for?
No, it's only 4 through 6 counties, and I think that is the way that the state is trying to distribute the TRT out to a rural county. I know San Juan is one they use a lot, that has a lot of visitor impacts, but doesn't generate a lot of revenue. So I think a San Juan could put in for that grant and be very, very successful. We would probably not even put in for the grant because we're such a high-producing county as far as TRT goes.
Yeah, and then with this expanded use of how to spend TRT, any ideas how the county might spend it?
Well, it really does mirror the emergency services sales tax. So it does become moot to some degree, but just any time we have increased flexibility, it's a good thing. We'll be very careful about it. We're not going to spend it in ways that we shouldn't, but the 3% that we generate here locally, 2% of that goes to the chamber for promotion and marketing, and that 1% that we retain, we would just like to make sure that any way that we can mitigate the impacts of tourism on our residents, we want to do that.
All right. Any other legislative issues the county's following that we want to mention?
The only other one that really is on my mind is HB 256, which is the short-term rental regulations to counties. I believe this is a good bill. I believe this does give us some flexibility and remove some of the restrictions we had on monitoring short-term rentals. I think you're going to see from the county some. We've already got an RFP out for a software system that will help us manage this better. That really is... coming together well with this bill that would give us that ability to monitor these better. We want to get everybody registered. We want to get everybody paying the TRT, whether that's through an Airbnb or a hotel, get everybody on a level playing surface. And then just where are short-term rentals in our county? Where should they be and where shouldn't they be? I think we want to take a proactive approach to that this year.
All right. And then outside of the new bill that hasn't yet been numbered, any other bills out there that would impact land use?
Well, maybe one other one is the HB 37. I think you and I talked about this a couple weeks ago. That's the density overlay. We're still waiting to see how that would really work. But anytime a bill potentially forces density on your community, whether that's in a residential zone or anywhere else, we're very concerned about that.
All right. In other business, Wednesday, the council will discuss and possibly approve a resolution to create the Summit County Housing Authority bylaws. Then what?
I think that we've already started advertising for commissioners, so we've got the feedback from the council about, I think some of our questions at the last meeting were, should we have five commissioners or seven? Where should these folks be? Who should they represent? How many council members do we want on this commission? And then also a key piece of feedback we got from the council was, who is able to change the bylaws? Is this organization, this housing authority, able to do that independently, or does the county council want to retain that ability to change the bylaws? And they did retain that. So we got all that feedback back. I think Jeff Jones has put together the ordinance that we're ready to pass, and we want to get going. Like I said, we've already advertised for the commissioners, so we're going through a two-track process here, and we're hoping the council will adopt these bylaws and we can get going.
All right, and as we reported, we are seeing possible cuts to the health department as a result of federal cutbacks to spending. Anything you're concerned about that could jeopardize county funding after July 1?
Well, I don't know about the date, Leslie. We're 60% funded by federal funds. I mean, we are very concerned, and I appreciate Dr. Phil's Bondurant's leadership in this case. He's cutting funding, and that anything that's not absolutely essential is not going to go. And I think that's just taking a proactive, precautionary measure. I think the insurity is really what's hard for us right now. That executive order came out, and then it was rescinded, and we just feel like we're in a little bit of a limbo here. So we're just trying to be careful and cautiously optimistic that we can continue operations as we need.
Yeah, are you taking any actions at this point just to kind of rein things in, just in case?
Besides what the health department is doing, we have talked to all the departments that are affected by grants. Most of our departments are affected by grants in sort of a one-time, they're not ongoing grants. The health department is the exception to that. So those that are using grants for operations are the ones we're being the most cautious about. But we're optimistic that those kinds of essential services will remain.
Okay, and I'm guessing, you know, with the news reported last week about last year's Senate Bill 258, though the supporters of the referendum on the Dakota Pacific ordinance saying it is possibly unconstitutional. Do you have your attorneys looking into that?
We don't have the attorneys looking into that at this time. It's a debatable question. It's certainly not a slam dunk. Leslie, just generally, if you ask me about the power of the legislature, I'm nervous. I don't believe that we can. I think when a law is passed and we fight that law, I think the legislature can then go in the next year and just undo what we just fought. I don't believe that this is a fight that we can win. I believe they are the body that makes the laws in the state of Utah, and in some way that we're going to have to be deferent to that. And it's a challenge. I don't like it, but we try to respect the legislature and what they do. We try to work with them and collaborate with them. And to say that if they did something that it was unconstitutional, that's just would be a tremendous reach, and I wouldn't want to make any decisions based on that information.
Okay, and then of course this we've got a lawsuit still somewhere hanging out, right, with regard to the county and Dakota Pacific. We had heard that was going to be on pause until we could work this out. So what's going on there?
It is on pause. It is certainly still a viable option. I believe there was a clause in the development agreement amendment that would put that lawsuit to bed once we agreed to something. I believe that's probably part and parcel to why that development agreement amendment hasn't been signed yet. So we are just still waiting to see what happens with the referendum. We're still worried about what the legislature might do. We're still worried about the preliminary municipality, what that might look like. There's just so many moving parts, and right now we don't feel like the lawsuit needs to be active.
All right, and also as we reported that Hideout does have that right to annex some 350 acres of Richardson Flat. What are you hearing? What were we going to do with it? And does it make sense then, you know, to allow them some kind of commercial development to keep them from coming in on 248?
I'm not sure if it makes sense or not. We have interacted with the Larry H. Miller Group, who has some ownership in that area, with the Cedar Crest process, and so they've brought that up before. I know that Park City Municipal is right there as well, so there's a lot of moving parts there. I actually saw Matt Dias on Friday, and we are going to have a conversation about that area soon, and we'd like to be proactive and do some master planning and what that looks like. There's still some hurt feelings between Hideout and Summit County. I'm not going to pretend that there are not. We don't like how that went down, and we don't like the result either. At the same time, if this is something that we need to work together for what's best for our community, we'll certainly do that.
Okay. Shane, anything else you wanted to mention?
Maybe just that we had a couple of open houses for the 910 that were so well attended, so successful, lots of great feedback. The survey that we did was very well utilized. We had a lot of feedback on that as well. Some very clear direction from the community, at least, on a couple of items, and we're excited to continue to roll that out. We have one more open house in March, and I'll try to highlight that as it gets closer.
Okay, Shane, thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a wonderful day.
That's Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Still to come, we'll be checking in with KUER reporter Sage Miller with our weekly Utah Legislative Report. Later on, I'll be talking with CEO of Park City Community Foundation, Joel Zero, and Park City School District's Caleb Fine, discussing the We All Belong Kindness Awards and the new Community Belonging Fund. On the phone now with a recap of this year's state legislative session, I've got for week three, KUER reporter Sage Miller. Good morning, Sage.
Good morning, Leslie.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with a couple of bills that could impact the Wasatch Back. First is House Bill 456. This allows, as we just heard from County Manager Shane Scott, new uses for transient room tax. What's this about?
Yeah, so I know, Summit County and Park City specifically have a lot of tourism, whether that be Sundance or the ski industry up there, people just wanting to be outdoors. So this one looks like it does loosen up a lot of the prior regulations around this tax and expands what cities can use it for. One thing that really caught my eye in this bill was that it says that it can be used for film and conventions now. And I do wonder if this is kind of a way to say, hey, Park City or hey, Summit County, we're willing to feed more money into the Sundance Film Festival in order to keep them in order to have them stay here instead of potentially moving into a different city. It also says that cities and counties can go into agreements on how to use this revenue and how to, maybe it's using it for, you know, some cities and some county projects and coming together to help fund it. And then it also says that a section of or a portion of the tax will be going into a specific fund that is a state fund that deals with outdoor recreation. And then it also says that it can use this money to help build roads that can connect or help infrastructure, build up infrastructure that can connect to different tourist destinations as well. So I will say this bill is very, very early in the process. As you said, it's HB 456. So it's pretty far down on the calendar right now. It's waiting for a committee hearing. But it sounds like, yeah, it's definitely trying to loosen some restrictions that were previously in place for how this tax could be used. And I'm sure y'all will be keeping a very close eye on how it will impact the Summit County area.
Yeah. So that's how it is done, huh? I mean, it's basically the number is how it's heard.
Not necessarily. I'm just saying this bill got filed pretty late into the session so far, and so it got assigned to a committee. It just wasn't one of the very first bills that they've heard yet in the session.
Got it. And then House Bill 309, we also had an update from County Manager Shane Scott. This is the one that would prohibit Utah counties and cities from restricting hunting on lands that they purchase or own. We just heard that we have some assurance here in Summit County that the sponsor will be pulling that bill. What do you know?
I really don't know anything. I was looking at this as well, and it just says it's in a standing committee as of the 3rd. So we're waiting for it to be heard in the House Natural Resources and Agricultural Committee, the House Natural Resources Agricultural Environment Committee. There's a good chance that when the bill sponsor gets up there, he say, hey, we're going to hold this bill, or I'm going to pull this bill, or it just will never be heard within the committee. So there's still some movement that could be made on this. Representative Casey Snyder, who is in Cache County, he could make some big changes to the bill within that time period. So we're still very early on in the process of what this bill could look like. And so it could go either way. And I wouldn't put it past the legislature to push something through, even if people aren't super on board with it. And Casey Snyder has a pretty good repertoire with leadership. He is a part of leadership. So we'll see what he does.
I'll talk about pushing things through. House Bill 267 has flip-flopped a few times. This, again, is the bill that bans collective bargaining, but only for public sector unions like teachers or police and fire. Again, I think there was some hope that some concession would be made, and then they went back and did exactly what they had said that they were going to do up front.
Yeah, so the legislature, I think, is pretty good at giving whiplash to a lot of its constituents and to Utahns in general. And they even said that on the Senate floor when they were talking about this bill. As you said, it does completely restrict public sector unions. That's your teachers, your firefighters, your police officers, and some of your municipal workers from being able to collectively bargain with their employer. And last week, there was, or maybe 2 weeks ago, I don't know, at this point, everything blurs together, Leslie. But at some point, the legislature did put the ability to collective bargain back into the bill. They said, you know, you would need 50% plus one of whatever of all of the employees. So if it was all teachers, even if they're not unionized, need to essentially be on board with the priorities that the union would put forth to try and negotiate with the employer or the legislature or your local governments, whatever that may be. And the Senate sponsor, Kirk Collamore, Republican Kirk Collamore, said, we're hoping that we can get to a consensus with these unions, that they will be neutral on it, not necessarily supporting it, but they don't absolutely hate it. And he said last week on the floor that they could not come to that agreement. And since they could not come to an agreement with unions and there wasn't enough on board to be neutral, that they were just going to revert it back to the original bill, which was effectively banning collective bargaining across the board for public sector unions. The thing that was interesting about this is that I have never seen so many people turn out to the Capitol to oppose a bill. On Friday, over 1,000 public sector union members flooded the Capitol to try and encourage Governor Spencer Cox to veto this bill because it is on the way to him. And what I will say is that we don't know what Spencer Cox is going to do. He says that he is reviewing the bill, but he has a few options here. One, he signs the bill and it goes into effect. Two, he has 12 days to sign it. And if he doesn't sign it, it automatically goes into law. Or three, he could veto the bill, which is what a lot of constituents and public sector union members are calling on the governor to do. If he were to veto this bill, it doesn't have a override. It doesn't have a veto-proof majority in the legislature. So there's a good chance that it wouldn't go into effect if it were to be vetoed. In the Senate, they were up by one vote. And in the House, they were up by 3, which means they barely had enough support to get it across the finish line.
Okay, that's interesting, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you. You know, it's like they've got a supermajority. They can do pretty much what they want and override a governor's veto if they have the votes. Interesting.
But it doesn't really seem like they have the votes on how it is built right now. Getting it through the Senate with one vote to spare is kind of by the skin of your teeth, getting it to the governor.
Well, and if it is allowed to go into law, I mean, it basically just would crush the unions, the most vocal of whom, of course, is the Utah Education Association, where we have seen lawsuits filed. But they have done a great job in terms of getting some good concessions from the legislature in terms of funding teacher pay and other education issues. I guess I just don't understand. I mean, is it the legislature's like, we've had enough, you know, we're just go away, UEA? Because that's what it would do.
That's what a lot of people have argued, right? Where there is a lot of public sector unions within the state that do not participate in collective bargaining. However, they would appreciate the option in the future to have that in their tool belt, right? With the UEA, I've talked to the bill sponsor and Jordan, Republican Representative Jordan Tusher, and he says this wasn't necessarily retaliatory. This is just because people feel like they aren't having their voices heard. And he says this isn't going to kill unions whatsoever, because a union member can go directly to their employer and collectively bargain, and then union can do some stuff. But I think you're right, is that a lot of people feel that this is slated, specifically with the UEA and their opposition to Amendment A, which never made it on the ballot during the 2024 election. But that was the bill that said, hey, let's remove the constitutional earmark on education, and in return, we will remove the state sales portion, the state portion of the sales tax on food. And they were, apparently the UEA at some point was neutral on the bill, but then they rescinded that. I mean, they were neutral on the constitutional amendment. They rescinded that, and they came out in opposition of it. And so people believe that this is this bill of banning collective bargaining is in retaliation for them stripping their support of Amendment A.
Okay, let's move on. What's the latest with House Bill 269? This is the trans college dormitory bill.
Yes, that one is on its way to the governor. It passed the final hurdle yesterday, and the governor has signaled that he most likely will sign it. And just for listeners, little recap, is that this is a bill that would ban transgender students from living in sex-designated dorms that align with their gender identity. So they have three options. One, live off a campus that doesn't have any school tie to it. The second one is live in a sex-designated room that aligns with, matches your sex assigned at birth. Or your third option is a gender neutral dorm that you would have to opt into. And the bill sponsor, Representative Stephanie Grecius, who is a Republican, says that this is where trans and non-binary and anybody who feels comfortable living with those folks could opt in to live in that. And that gives the university's power to create that kind of housing. Opponents say that this targets transgender people and students, makes their lives harder and potentially outs them and essentially strips them of their privacy. So again, it's the fourth year in a row that we've seen transgender legislation in front of the legislature. But I will say that this bill specifically is one of the very first in the nation.
All right, and finally wanted to wrap up with House Bill 300. Basically mandates people would have to show ID when they drop their ballot in the mail or at a ballot drop box, which just seems difficult. Does it just do away with basically mail-in voting? Let's just go back to in-person voting, no?
Yeah, so this is a bill I'm watching very, very closely because it is a massive overhaul to the election system Utah currently has in place. We are one of eight states that have universal mail-in voting, and this one is putting voter ID laws onto it. So what they're saying is everybody would still get their ballot in the mail, but they couldn't return their ballot in the mail. They would have to go to a drop box or a polling place and physically show their ID to a poll worker in order to drop it off. Some people argue that's completely getting rid of the entire point of mail, vote by mail. It's taking away the convenience. They have an extra step to go do it. And there's also accessibility concerns, specifically with individuals who are disabled and who are homebound and aren't able to get out. And there's other concerns about people who work, who aren't able to leave work in order to submit their ballot. So that's why they do it in the mail. It's also a huge cost burden on counties. All counties together, all of Utah's 29 counties, it's expected to be $6 million of ongoing funding in order to make this change. This has rocky bipartisan support. It did pass out of committee, but at least three Republicans said, hey, if you don't address these concerns, I'm not voting for this on the House floor. So they're giving the bill sponsor an opportunity to make some changes, especially on the fiscal note, and to at least allow vote by mail in some scenarios. But I will say House Majority Leader Mike Schultz is a huge fan of this bill. He thinks it's going to make elections more secure in Utah, although there is never been widespread evidence of voter fraud within the state. So some people argue that this is just a solution looking for a problem.
Yeah, I was going to say, we loved mail-in voting, and then sounds like the honeymoon's over. I got to bring this up. Senate Bill 230, this is important. I mean, it would legislate how to spell Utah. And for those of you who like to put an A in there, you do it. But they want to legislature wants to make sure that everybody knows how to spell U-T-A-H-N, no A. I just want to know, man, if you do put an A in there, what's going to happen to you?
I don't think anything happens to you. I think that this is just a procedural bill. The Senate sponsor for it, Republican Dan McKay, made a poll on X, was like, how do you spell Utah? And most people voted for that. And so he's like, let's do a bill file on it. So I think it's mostly one of just like those soft, it's just like putting it in the state constitution, not the state constitution, but in the state codes that's how you spell it. So there's no confusion, but it's not like you're going to get arrested or a fine if you add an A.
Yeah, it'll be on every spelling test now in grades one through five. Okay, Sage, anything else you want to mention?
No, I think that we've covered it. As you said, it's been not as pedal to the metal as we've seen in past sessions, but things are really kind of starting to pick up. We're seeing more immigration bills go through, more election bills. There is one bill that would make Election Day a state holiday. So maybe that solves some of the issue of not being able to vote if you're at work or something like that. But that's the things that they're focused on, is immigration and elections.
All right. Sage Miller, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Sage Miller, again, a reporter with KUER Radio in Salt Lake City. The Park City School District has launched the We All Belong Kindness Awards. This is in partnership with the Park City Community Foundation. In studio with details, I have the CEO of the Community Foundation, Joel Zero, along with the interim CTE director from Park City Schools, Caleb Fine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Caleb, this was a school district initiative?
Yeah, so I had the opportunity when I was in the interim superintendent role to spend some time with Joel brainstorming on how we could better address kindness within our schools. You know, thinking about the OCR complaint, right, and our resolution agreement, and knowing that we wanted to go above and beyond and truly make kindness the norm, make kindness cooler than hate. And Joel and I were able to have great dialogue, and out of it came a very exciting award.
Okay, so this is not required by the requirements from the Office of Civil Rights.
No, this is really trying to change our DNA.
All right. So maybe tell us, what are the awards? Who gives them? Who gets them?
Yeah, so this is for students and educators. So the idea is, we believe some of the best movement in changing the narrative in our schools and changing the culture in our schools to promote kindness will be the grassroots, the things that happen by the students and by the teachers, by the educators, not just teachers, but truly all educators. So on a monthly basis, we're awarding students and teachers, and there's some swag included with that, some water bottles, and then at the end of the year, we're gonna nominate, there'll be nominations for out of those winners for the grand champions of who really promote belonging and kindness within our schools, both a teacher and a student award.
So does this happen monthly in each school or district-wide?
Monthly in each school. So a lot of celebration. In fact, my daughter was recently nominated. I got a lot of excitement when she came home with a ticket, because I knew about this award. I didn't know she was going to get it, but that's an example of a kindergartner who a teacher or a student pointed out and said, hey, this student has been kind and going above and beyond. You better believe my heart as a parent lit up when I knew my daughter was demonstrating the kindness that we're looking for in this community.
All right. Give me an example. I mean, what does a kid do at a...
I think at an elementary level, in kindergarten, it's likely a kid going up to a student and bringing a student in that hasn't been playing with someone else, right? Mm-hmm. That's a big deal, especially at the lower elementary level. And if you move into the secondary level, it might be the student who is not in a leadership group or typically not awarded, who's starting to do things on a consistent basis to develop friend groups or to invite people in that haven't been a part of the norm so far. So really, there is no, this is the requirement. It's others identifying that is the culture that we want in our school district.
Mm-hmm. How big of a problem is the bullying, the harassment, and discrimination? I mean, you've seen some of the schools.
Yeah, I mean, I have had the privilege of being at all the schools. How big of a problem is it? You know, we're very blessed in this community. Is it happening every day and every moment? The answer is absolutely not. But it's a big deal if it's your kid. So I can tell you, we have all the greatest data in the world. And if it's my kid that's being bullied or harassed or exposed to hate speech, the data doesn't matter anymore. And we know that hate speech has been used and is still being used. It hasn't been eradicated yet. But so how big of a deal? It's a huge deal, because if it's your kid, it doesn't matter what the data says. We've got to address that, and that's the heart of this award.
Yeah, kids are smart, though. They know when not to say something, right? I mean, so are we really seeing the extent of the problem, or are we hearing more from the kids themselves saying, this happened to me?
I think that, kids are very savvy, especially at the secondary level. I don't expect them to do things in front of adults, for example. They try not to get in trouble. They're good at that. But with our new reporting systems, I'm optimistic that we're aware of a lot of the issues and working very hard to address those.
All right. Well, tell me about the awards. You mentioned monthly water bottles, but Joel, I think that's where the Community Foundation comes in. You're putting money behind this?
Yeah. So we've provided $17,500 over the course of the next five or so months. And every school is allocated $1,000 each to award grade level prizes to each of the kids that wins an award. And then at the end of the year, each of the seven schools, an educator will be nominated by his or her peers, and the school site council and leadership will award one award to an educator, and that's $1,000. And then, as Caleb mentioned, there are going to be two grand prize winners, one student who's already won an award and one educator. And they'll be the grand prize winners, and the student will be awarded a $1,000 scholarship, and the educator will be awarded a $2,500 stipend.
Okay. So the scholarship for what? College, future?
That's right.
Yeah.
College and future.
And then the stipend for the teacher, anything they want?
Anything they want. That's right. We just really want to highlight people who have gone above and beyond. You know, in my discussions with Caleb, when we were thinking of what are we going to do here, it was so clear that Caleb and all of the district leadership wanted to go above and beyond, checking the boxes to clear themselves of the OCR report. That's the
Office of Civil Rights report.
You know, it's more than just ticking boxes. They really are after fostering a culture of kindness and excellence across the district. And they're one of our most important institutions in Park City. So, of course, the Park City Community Foundation is going to get behind that.
Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have had a problem asking this, Caleb, but what is the latest on those investigations? Are cases being closed? And
yeah, so the Office of Civil Rights, there's a resolution mm-hmm. agreement. It's a two-year agreement. I'm very confident that we're meeting all of the requirements of the resolution agreement. And, you know, our commitment is not just to meet, but exceed that, meaning in 2 years, you meet, you check all the boxes, as Joel said, and the resolution goes away. The OCR stops monitoring, the Office of Civil Rights stops monitoring us. But we're committed to continuing the work regardless of the monitoring period.
Yeah, so who gets these updates from the OCR? I mean, does it go to the superintendent? Does it go to the students and their parents that have been affected by the investigation?
So the superintendency and the cabinet receives those and follows the monitoring letters. The Office of Civil Rights is a little bit slow right now. There's a lot that they're dealing with. They come out of the Department of Education, to be fully transparent. We're waiting on our next update to hear how we're doing. We've heard that they don't expect any concerns. And then as far as the complainants, for lack of a better term, those people that have been negatively impacted, they're complaining about appropriate things. So I don't want to make that sound negative. But they likely are in touch with the attorney of the Office of Civil Rights, but I don't know for sure their exact communication along the way.
Okay. Joel, you've also started your new Community Belonging Fund. That's different than the We All Belong Kindness Awards?
It is different. It's a different initiative, but it all falls under the same bucket of fostering community belonging in Park City. So when you think, you know, I was just driving here and I saw a line of kids, they're pre-K kids, holding onto the long rope with a bunch of little straps, and they're all walking in the same line. And I'm looking at those little ones, and I'm thinking, they don't care who's on the line with them. They don't care the color of their skin or their religion or what they had for breakfast. They're friends moving forward in a straight line. And I think our experience in Park City, we're impacted by the national context. We're impacted by the strikes that happened with the ski patrol. And this is more than just a school issue. This is a community issue. And we have to learn from our little pre-K kids that we can all hold the strap together and we can walk in a straight line and create the kind of community we want. We think, you know, the educators and the parents are teaching the kids. Well, we have a lot to learn from the kids. And so I hope that when Caleb's daughter comes to the table with her kindness ticket, and other kids do that at their dinner table, it fosters a family conversation about what is kindness, how do we foster kindness in our community, when do we need it most, and what can I specifically do about it. So it's about adults as much as it's about kids.
Okay, so you've got apparently some grant application processes to tap into this Community Belonging Fund?
For the Community Belonging Fund, we do. It's all for nonprofit organizations who are right now focused on helping members of our community who may be impacted by immigration-related issues. So we're focused on providing legal assistance, public education. What are your rights? What are your rights as employers? What are your rights as employees and community members? And then, if needed, direct cash assistance for people who are impacted by immigration-related challenges.
All right. How do people find out about how to apply for that?
You can go onto our website and search Community Belonging. It's right up front. Yeah. And our website is parkcitycf.org.
All right. And you've got that fund funded to the tune of how much?
Well, our goal is $500,000. We're right now around $300,000. And our first area of focus is helping a local nonprofit called Wasatch Immigration Project fund two full-time attorneys to help our community members navigate the legal challenges that they're facing.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to mention about this?
No, we're really excited, you know, in our district. Again, grateful for our partnership with the Community Foundation, and we want to create a snowball, a positive snowball that's making an impact in kids' lives every day, and we hope the communities.
Okay.
And if we can't be kind here in Park City, given how blessed we are, we've got to be leaders in this. So don't honk. Let the person in line cut in front of you. All these basic things. Smile at your neighbor. Simple things, but if we're not intentional, we might go the other way.
Okay. Joel Zero and Caleb Fine, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.